Fun fact, for a period of time between 1887 to 1954, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and parts of China were colonized by the French and grouped together to form French Indochina or French Indochine Française.
Cool. Yeah. The more you know. Yeah. I actually didn't know that, despite being Vietnamese.
I know there's like an area.
Like, I knew we were colonized by the French, but I didn't realize it was called Indochine.
Sorry, I was going to say something more to that, and then I just forgot. Okay.
Hi!
I'm Leanne.
I'm Tammy.
And you're listening to Incrimination. Birds.
Do we have anything to cover today?
I don't think so. We don't have that much. I think we finally hit 3,000 listens, so we like surpassed it sometime like last week. Something like that. I remember taking
an anchor?
Look. Yeah.
Like in total?
Yeah.
Cool.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, 3.3K.
Oh, hell yeah. See, I didn't even know it was that high.
We're getting there.
I love it.
Yeah. So, anyway, I guess we'll just hop right into today's topic of the Serpent, a.k.a. Charles Sobhraj.
Oh, my God. I can't wait for you to tell me this story so I can finally watch a Netflix series.
I kind of wish you did watch the Netflix series, because then...
Yeah, it's all good.
Like, I didn't watch the Netflix series, because I don't have time for anything. But it'd be cool to see, like, the differences between, you know, what was in the series and what actually took place.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this when I started researching the case, but...
Mm-hmm.
The day I started researching was the day of the premiere of the Netflix show, The Serpent.
Love that for you.
Yeah, so...
What a coincidence.
It was crazy because there was so much information. It was actually a little difficult because I tend to like to look at older sources because I feel like they're more reliable because like the more recent the sources, the more it's like been retranslated and like transposed and stuff.
The words are like weird.
Yeah, and like... It's easier to use like the original stuff because maybe it's a little more accurate. That's what I think. But it did open up a lot of opportunities for like new content to be made. Like, journalists were going crazy and like seeking like people who are involved in this case, like now to like tell more of their story. So I got to find a lot of articles from like people that I'll mention as well, just throughout the case. But it was really cool.
Shout out to the journalists, though, because I realized when I was doing that research for Andrew Kissel, journalists do a ton of, like, investigative work, and sometimes it takes years and years and years of work to, like, get anywhere with it. It's crazy.
And I'll mention it a lot in this case, too, like, a lot of journalists and, like, writers... Because he, a lot of content was made about him, like obviously this the Serpent, but there were also a lot of books and like his biography, and the thing about Charles was he loved to talk about himself and he loved the idea of making money from his, you know, his crimes or whatever. So there's tons and tons of content. So I was up until 4 in the morning finishing this research last night. If it's a little, like, loopy, I'm sorry.
But it's just your state of mind.
Yeah. And this is, you signed up for this. This is what you're going to get. I'm not going to improve, probably.
I'm ready.
And also, due to just, like, how big, like, the scale of his crimes were, just a spoiler alert, right off the bat, he murdered between 12 to 24 people across many, many different countries. And so there were a lot of journalists that wanted to know more and were, like, seeking him out. And since he was traveling all over the place, like, people would, like, hunt him down in all these different countries.
Holy.
Yeah, so this one's a bit of a doozy.
All right. Is this going to be one part or two parts? I can't remember.
I'm going to make it one part, but it's going to be a long part, one-parter. It's going to be, like, Frog Boys.
Oh, hell yeah. We love hell those long episodes.
And Frog Boys did really well. Like,
yeah.
People really like the
Frog Boys
episode.
I think people like long episodes, too.
It's just, like, on us, on our part. The you can cut this out, but it's just, like, the research part is, like, it helps to have it in two separate parts, right? Because you can do one batch, like, beginning and then do the second batch afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. It helps with, like, our mental health.
Yeah.
But yeah, this will be a one part, or like a single part.
A long part.
Like no two-parters this time.
No cliffhangers.
Because we did two-parters in a row.
Yeah.
And I feel like we deserve a whole part.
Yes. All right, let's get started.
All right, let's get into it. I'm going to start things off with, not Charles, but I'm going to start it off with Marie-André Leclerc, who was born on July 26, 1945 in Quebec, Canada.
Canada?
Yeah, she's from Canada. So Leclerc finished her studies in Quebec City, then joined a clinic as a medical secretary in Lévis, another city in Quebec province, Canada. Apparently, she was having relationship troubles with her boyfriend at the time, so she went on vacation to Kashmir, India, where she met Alain Gauthier, a photojournalist working for Paris Match magazine. In fact, it was not Alain Gauthier, but it was rather Charles Sobrage, and he was not a photojournalist working for Paris Match magazine.
Huh?
But he apparently guided her on her travels, and somehow she fell in love with him.
Oh my god.
He made her a promise at the end of the trip that she would come back to see him in Asia, and they would often send each other letters just back and forth from wherever he was in the world. Charles told her that he loved her and wanted to marry her one day. And one day he sent her a one-way ticket to Bangkok, Thailand. In June of 1975, Marie broke up with her boyfriend in Canada and flew to Thailand to spend some time with Charles. So that's Marie.
All right.
And now I'll talk a bit about Charles.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles Hachand Bawandi Sobrage was half Indian, half Vietnamese, born in 1944 in Vietnam. So he was 1 year older than Marie Leclerc. Mm-hmm. His mother, a Vietnamese woman, was actually his father's mistress. And so while his dad was a very successful Indian Shindi businessman, he abandoned the family pretty early on, and Charles was often pushed back and forth between his two biological parents. His mother's boyfriend that she later met, who we'll call his stepfather, mm-hmm. was a French army officer who sent Charles to a boarding school in France. And so Charles was back and forth a lot between France and Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
And it's speculated that this is where he started his slippery ways, always trying to ditch boarding school.
Mm-hmm. Where was he from again? Like, where was he born?
Saigon. Mm-hmm. He was from Vietnam.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I should have clarified that. My bad.
All good.
He even attempted to escape back to Saigon several times by stowing away on a ship. He did this twice. And one time he made it as far as Djibouti. So if you don't know, like if you look at the world map, France is on the west side of Europe and Vietnam is on the east side of Asia. So that's like a long ways to go. And Djibouti falls just almost halfway, a little closer to France, on the northeast side of Africa.
Did he take it by, like, boat, like, all the way, or was it else, like, he was, like, traveling basically land and everything?
Yeah. Well, he would, like, he took a boat from France to Africa, and then he would have to go through land and then, like, take another boat from, like, Africa to Asia.
How ambitious.
I know.
That is very ambitious. I love it.
He was found in Djibouti and was sent back to France.
Yeah.
And as you can probably expect, he committed a lot of petty crimes in his teenage years. He was quite the rebellious man who got his first prison sentence at 19 for burglary near Paris in 1963. He spent 3 years at Poissy Prison, where he made a friend. Actually, he manipulated and used this poor boy. But one of the prison volunteers was a guy named Félix Descogne, who came from a pretty wealthy family. After Charles got out of jail on parole, Descogne actually let Charles live with him, where he relied on scams and burglaries until 1969, around the same time he met Chantal Compagnon, a young French woman who came from a conservative family. he promised to go straight for her and propose to her within weeks of meeting her. Later that day, as in the day of the proposal, he was arrested a second time for a car chase with the police in a stolen vehicle. This time he was sentenced to 8 months in Poissy prison.
This man.
Like, Leanne, this is like the beginning of it. I was telling you last night, it's so nutty because he's just in and out of prison constantly. When he got out of Poissy prison, the couple actually married and fled to Asia in 1970. They later settled in Mumbai, where they had their daughter, Usha, where Charles continued to run a pretty successful car theft / smuggling ring.
What a successful businessman. Let me run a smuggling ring for cars. Perfect.
Yep. In 1973, about 3 years later, Charles met Gloria Mandelic, a Spanish cabaret dancer, and apparently kept her prisoner for 3 days in her hotel room at the Hotel Ashoka in New Delhi. She said that Charles pretended to be an owner of a hotel chain and was offering her a contract, but he stole her keys and tried to drill through her floor while she was performing in the hotel nightclub because her room was above a jewelry store. But the drill snapped. So he convinced Gloria to pretend to be a prospective buyer of the jewels from the store underneath them and asked the jeweler to bring up some expensive jewelry to her room, which she did. She obliged because, mm-hmm. you know, he was armed. And the jeweler sent up an assistant to the room. The mm-hmm. poor assistant was met with a gun pointed at him, and Charles proceeded to drug both the assistant and Gloria. He then called the jeweler himself up, drugged him too, and tied them all together, where he then took the jeweler's keys, waltzed into the shop, filling a large canvas bag with about 1.5 million Indian rupees worth of jewels, which is just over $20,000 US, mm-hmm. and fled.
This guy's ballsy as fuck.
Dude, the balls on this guy are fucking humongous. About 3 hours later, the drugs wore off and the authorities were notified. They assumed he would try to flee the country, so they ran to the airport while he was waiting at customs for an Air France flight to Paris.
Yeah.
Somehow, Charles caught sight of the jeweler's assistant, who accompanied police to help identify Charles. So he told the customs officer he had to go to the toilet. So he went and changed his look because he was a master of disguise, mm-hmm. and dipped the fuck out of there.
How? I'm so excited to watch the Netflix documentary because we're just barely scratching the surface of this already, and I'm already intrigued by this man.
I'm on page two and there's 11 pages in my notes.
Okay, perfect. Love it.
He's on... Oh, wow. Just wow. I'm surprised. Yeah. I've never heard about him before.
Yeah, me too. I'm wondering if I heard about it in a podcast, but I can't remember.
I definitely have not. Yeah. But
crazy.
2 weeks after that incident, he showed up at a 5-star hotel in Bombay called the Taj Mahal. He tried to swindle a young tourist, but the tourist was suspicious of him, and he was arrested for being in possession of an unlicensed revolver, the same one he used in the jewelry store burglary in New Delhi. It was only then that they realized that he was the same man from that robbery, and he was sent back to New Delhi for a trial. He escaped prison by faking appendicitis.
Oh my god.
And I read in one article from India Today, they actually said that he really did get appendicitis, mm-hmm. and it was just, like, crazy timing. But he managed to escape from the hospital. And he was apparently handcuffed to the hospital bed and guarded by two policemen. And the story is unclear as to how he got past them, but he did. Somehow the policemen tracked him down to the railway station where he was found buying tickets at the counter. Yeah. And they arrested him once again.
Nice.
But since he didn't have that extensive of a criminal record, he called up his stepfather, who was living in Saigon, the French military officer from before, and asked him to borrow bail money.
Yeah.
And his stepfather agreed to it, and he immediately fled to Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, with Chantel, sending their daughter back to Chantel's parents in Paris to protect her now that they were wanted by Indian police.
Nice. Great way to drag your family into this. Love it.
Yeah. There's also a theory that before going to Afghanistan, he actually went across the Indian border into Pakistan, where he hired a taxi from Rawalpindi to Peshawar. The taxi that they refer to was found abandoned along a road with the dead body of the driver inside, who was killed by poisoning. And this theory actually lines up with Charles' story of his first murder. He claimed that he killed a taxi driver in Pakistan in 1972. But the timeline says that this would have been around 1973. So it's unclear whether or not this was the same one he was referring to. But that is the going theory.
Yeah.
In that same year in Afghanistan, he was arrested again for stealing a car and not paying the hotel bill where he was staying with his wife.
He just can't, like, stay out of trouble. I love it. It's just, so he did this and he got arrested again and he escaped and he got arrested again and then he got arrested again.
You'll never guess what happens next, Leanne.
He got arrested.
Yeah. And you'll never guess what happens after that.
And he gets arrested again, goes to jail, escapes something, and gets arrested.
Actually, yeah, he escapes Afghanistan jail by faking illness, drugging the guards, leaving his wife in Kabul prison.
Oh my god. Oh my god, he left his wife there?
Yes, but it's okay, because you know what? He returned to France, kidnapped his daughter from her grandparents, because she was staying with Chantal's parents, and headed back to Asia to bust his wife out of jail.
Oh, hell yeah.
Hell yeah. What the fuck? But he was arrested and imprisoned in Tehran because they suspected he was selling firearms to the anti-Shah underground. So when she got out of jail, she met an American man and took Usha to live with him in the United States, vowing never to see Charles again.
Good on you. Good on you, lady. Like, she just got out of there.
Good job, Chantel.
Yeah.
Love that for you.
Damn.
So it's unclear if he escaped prison or if he actually held out his sentence. Mm-hmm. But eventually he got out, and for 2 years he was on the run. And was said to have used as many as 10 stolen passports, visiting countries from all over Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And most of his targets were beatniks, which were like, you know, hippies who were from the West, who were attracted to, you know, the dreamy, psychedelic lifestyle of Southeast Asia, you know.
Yeah.
And they traveled along a route called the Hippie Trail, which was a trail that extended from Europe to South Asia, passing through Thailand, Nepal, and India, which is where he got the name the Hippie Trail Murderer. He would befriend American and European tourists using his fluency in multiple languages. So he knew French, English, Thai, Spanish, and Hindi. Would show them where to eat, where to buy gemstones, be real nice with them, drug them, rob them, get caught, arrested, and escape.
That escalated so quickly. This is also why, like, in combination with doing this podcast and also watching Criminal Minds, that I have developed such bad trust issues, because you're telling me this, where he's like, he would talk to them in, like, all of these different, like, he knew so many languages, so he was able to communicate with people and get along with people really easily. In my mind, I think charismatic, bad.
Yeah,
like when you're too charismatic, right? Like, it's you seem like a little bit too smooth, automatically I'm like, murderer.
Some guy opens the door for you, don't you fucking dare.
Don't touch me.
And if it wasn't clear by now, that's how he got his nickname, the Serpent, because he was so slippery and no one could ever catch him for a very long time. His motto was, when you feel the heat, go to the kitchen. Which just goes to show how well he performed under pressure. I don't know. That's what he loved to say.
Go to the kitchen to cook?
Yeah. I don't know.
Cook up another plan.
Yeah. He loved to cook up plans on how to escape. Yeah.
Exactly.
In 1975, he was joined by his younger brother, Andre, in Istanbul. The two of them became partners in crime, wreaking havoc in Turkey and Greece. Eventually, the two were arrested in Athens and sentenced to prison. but he escaped incarceration by swapping identities with his brother and setting a prison van on fire.
Oh!
And yes.
Wow.
His brother was left serving an 18-year sentence.
Oh my fucking God.
And his brother says that he once told him, "Always remember that their desire to keep me locked up is no match to my will to be free." Pretty spot on, I think.
Yeah, no, the fact that he's gotten away, I haven't kept count. I lost count already. Like, it's
at least four by now.
Yeah, yeah. we're at quite a few. So, you know, that is a true statement.
And he hasn't even started, like, his big murder spree yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, after he got out of Athens, yeah. I believe this is where Marie-André Leclerc joined him in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And not only Marie-André, but Charles had a small group of people who traveled with him, which they refer to like his gang or his clan.
This sounds like Manson.
A little bit, yeah. Like a bunch of hippies just following this random dude.
Yeah.
One man named Dominique Relenaud stayed with Charles and his clan, reported that he fell ill when drinking something that Marie gave him, but then recovered under Charles' care, which is not sus at all.
Yeah.
Apparently, Charles's poison of choice was usually Mandrax, which usually took a few hours to take effect. So he would chit-chat with his victims, take them out, and eventually return to their hotel room with them, where his victims would succumb to the drugs, and he would rob them.
Nice, solid. Great.
Yeah. It is said that most of the murders in Thailand were actually of people who followed him and threatened to expose Charles for his crimes.
Oh my god. That sucks, though. Like, imagine being someone who like, falls and looks up to this man, and then you're like, oh, he sucks, and then get murdered.
Yeah, next thing you know, you're fucking dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the first known murder, like, again, the 1972 murder was, like, his claimed first one, but this is, like, the first known murder that was, like, attached to him. Mm-hmm. Teresa Ann Knowlton was a 21-year-old tourist from Seattle who met Subraj in Bangkok in 1975 on her way to joining a Buddhist monastery. Mm-hmm. In October, she was found drowned in the Gulf of Thailand wearing a floral bikini. A few days after the body was found, his accomplice, Marie-André Leclerc, cashed Teresa Knowlton's traveler's checks, and the authorities failed to connect the duo to Teresa's death. According to the novel The Life and Crimes of Charles Subraj, written by journalists Richard Neville and Julie Clark, Subraj disposed of her body with the help of another accomplice, AJ or Vijay Chowdhury, another one of his followers that was said to be his right-hand man. Mm-hmm. Richard and Julie are pretty well-known for documenting the life and crimes of Charles Subraj. Later on, they actually spent, like, a lot of time interviewing him and, like, people involved in the case. And they also helped, or they were also, like, the basis for the documentary, mm-hmm. The Serpent. Mm-hmm. So they're, like, pretty well-known in people who know the story of The Serpent.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The second known victim was a Turkish man named Vitali Hakim. Specifically, he was a Sephardic Jew whose body was found burned after Charles stole his passport, and his remains were found on the road to Pattaya Resort. After that, there were two Dutch students that met Subraj in Hong Kong, Henricus or Henk Bintanja, age 29, and Cornelia Hemker, age 25. Two Dutch students were lured, poisoned, strangled, and burnt on December 16, 1975. Their bodies were discovered 2 days later on December 18th, 1975. Shortly after that, Vitali, the second victim, his French girlfriend, Charmaine Carreau, was drowned shortly after his death, supposedly because she went looking for him and could have exposed Charles and his gang for the murder.
Oh my god. Yeah. Imagine going to, like, look. Shit, that sucks. Like, both of them just got murdered because...
Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, it's really sad.
Is there... I don't know if there's, like... Maybe you'll say it later, but, like, why Did he do this? Was it just like a crime of opportunity? Like he just saw these people and he was like, I want to kill.
Well, he wanted to like scam them, right? And then it's like, oh, yeah. he knows my face. So if he wakes up, he's going to identify me and I'm going to go to prison. And I don't want to go to prison. So let me just kill him.
Oh, Jesus.
And I'll kind of explain his mindset more. Somebody else talks about it later on. But yeah, that's just how Sobhraj worked. He was really like spontaneous and his like, if he sees something and he wants it, he'll just go for it.
So just very like impulsive in terms of how he approaches his. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Charmaine, Vitaly's girlfriend, was also found in a floral bikini. And this is what led to him being called the Bikini Killer.
He has so many names.
so far we have three nicknames: is the Serpent, Hippie Trail Murderer, and the Bikini Killer. I'm titling this episode "The Serpent" because that's the one that the Netflix documentary used. So I feel like people will understand which one I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he went by a lot of names. I think there's a few more, but I don't mention them because it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
I think one book also calls him the Cobra instead of the Serpent.
That sounds
so. Yeah, all of these murders happened in Pattaya, Thailand in 1975. There was also apparently another American woman who was murdered named Jenny Bolivar, but I couldn't find that much more information on her. Mm-hmm. In that same year, the police raided a flat in Bangkok where the three of them, so Charles, Marie, and AJ, were arrested. But they were released 24 hours later, apparently due to lack of evidence. There's also speculation that it was due largely to bribery.
I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because at this point, I would assume he had enough money, considering the amount of people he scammed and killed.
So, the same day that the bodies were found of Hank and Cornelia, Leclerc and Sobhraj used Hank and Cornelia's passports to escape Thailand and enter Nepal. Apparently, he just replaced the photos on the passports and no one
was 1975, so maybe they just
technology just wasn't there. This is where they murdered Canadian Laurent Ormond Carrier and Californian Connie Jo Bronzig. It is also said that they murdered Laddie Dupar and Annabelle Tremont, although less information is available about these two. So far the death toll is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. These murders were said to have occurred between December 21st and 22 in 1975 in Kathmandu. Mm-hmm. And mind you, he had been in Kathmandu for less than a week.
That's insane. Yeah, Jesus, that's so impulsive. He literally was just like, hey, I want to scam you. And then stabby stabby, or however he killed
stabby,
them.
Stabby stabby.
Drowny drowny.
Usually choky choky, drowny drowny, or stabby stabby.
Yeah.
Those were his.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Usually druggy druggy first, though.
Oh yeah, druggy druggy first. It's insane, though, right? Like, you can't really predict it.
Yeah.
And you don't know what he's going to do next, like who he's going to go after next. You just have to figure out where he's going to be and then like stop him. Can you tell I've been watching a lot of Criminal Minds? Can you tell?
Yeah. And it's just so sad because a lot of the times, like, these are people who are, you know, down on their luck or like having troubles and they need someone to rely on and help them.
Yeah.
And he just preys on these weak individuals, and like, this guy knew what he was doing.
Yeah. And it sucks because people are going traveling, and I, like, from someone I love to travel and things like that. I'm still gonna do it. Like, if I die, I die. But, you know, it's stuff like this where it is scary. Like, you never know, because someone might come up to you pretending to help you and they're doing the exact opposite. They're like the person you want to avoid. So yeah, it's wild.
So the Californian girl that he murdered, Connie Jo Bronzig, apparently, Connie had last been seen with a mysterious French gemstone dealer who looked suspiciously like Charles, who went by the name Alain Gauthier, which is an alias that Charles often uses because he's not very original.
Yeah.
If you remember, that is the same name he introduced himself to with his current girlfriend, Marie-Andre Leclerc. Nepalese police actually questioned him this time, but he had taken on the identity of Henricus Bintanja, who he murdered in Thailand. So they let him go because they were confused and they're like, oh, I guess we have the wrong person.
How do you, like, I feel like Henricus, I don't remember the last name, but I feel like that's such a, because he's Dutch, right?
Yeah.
It's a very, very Dutch name.
Yeah.
And they looked at that and they were just like, checks out.
I mean,
I guess like you could always
hippies.
Have. Yeah.
And you, who knows, like he was biracial, so he could true. Like.
He could pass.
Like, he's white passing.
Yeah. That makes sense. Damn.
I mean, he's Indian Vietnamese, but he yeah. like, if you just shave him and like clean him up in a certain way or like changes the way he brushes yeah. his hair or like. He, like, I will post photos. He disguised himself pretty well.
That would make sense.
He then used Laurent and Connie's passports, who he just killed, to go back to Thailand because apparently some of Charles' followers snitched on him and reported him.
Oh my god.
They then somehow ended up in Bombay, India, where they murdered Israeli student Avani, or I've also read Alan, but mm-hmm. I think it's Avani. Jacob, who was found drugged to death in his hotel room. Using Avani's passport, Charles flew to Singapore, then to India, then back to Bangkok in March 1976 to do God knows what.
Kill more people.
Probably.
Yeah.
In the meantime, AJ Chaudhary was sent to Malaysia by Charles to collect gems. He apparently handed the gems to Charles and was never seen again. We don't know if Charles killed him, but that is the assumption. And it's only an assumption because his remains were never found. The only time he was apparently sighted was in Germany in 1976, and that claim was never proven. So we have no idea what happened to AJ Chaudhary.
Jeez. He could have died. I think he might have. Like, maybe
Charles... I think there's a huge chance that he died.
Like, Charles was just done with him. He's like, well, thank you. I got what I needed from you, so goodbye. Because
yeah.
he doesn't seem like he really cares about people. And I guess the other question nope. I had is, you mentioned he had, like, people who were following him and things like that, too. And mm-hmm. even though, I mean, kind of same thing with, like, Manson family and stuff, right? Like, mm-hmm. maybe he didn't kill... Maybe he killed, what, like, 12 to 24 people? Cool. But I wonder mm-hmm. how many other people died because of him or, like...
As a result of his actions, as a result, or, like...
Yeah.
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 I don't know. That's okay. And I don't think we ever will know because, no. you know, even most of the records, like every article I read said something different.
Yeah.
But the number's somewhere between 12 and 24, at least.
At least. Yeah. Oh, geez.
So back in India, they recruited three more members into their little gang. John Duisme, who was a balding real estate dealer. There's not much about John Duisme. I couldn't find anything else other than the fact that he was balding.
He's balding. yeah.
But I do feel bad about making fun of him because he, you know, people can't help it if they're balding. But that's yeah. the only like fact I could find about him. I yeah. couldn't find out where he's from or anything. Just yeah. the fact that he was a balding real estate dealer. That's it.
Perfect.
His second recruit was Mary Ellen Ether, who was a blonde nurse from Sydney, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And his third was Barbara Smith, who was a 22-year-old brunette who set off for India drawn in by escapism. You know, like most.
Yeah.
There was actually, I found an article from the Daily Mail who did an interview with Barbara Smith recently after the Serpent came out. Mm-hmm. They sought her out and did an interview with her.
Damn.
She's actually living under a fake name right now
yeah.
that they did not disclose, clearly. Good. But she's currently, like, 64 years old.
Yeah.
Her father ran the village post office in Barton Stacey in Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Barbara, he met Barbara through a Belgian traveler who she befriended since they were struggling to get by and had their money stolen from them.
Mm-hmm.
Charles posed as a rich gem dealer named Daniel and offered her a place to stay. Apparently, the gang didn't actually know Charles' real intentions, and they thought that he was trying to get rich by meeting rich Europeans to buy his gems or help him get back to Europe, because
yeah.
that's where he said that he was from. And by the time they realized what was happening, they were already being paid by him and thus already an accomplice to his crimes.
Yeah.
So I can see how people are like, oh, I had no idea, but then it was already too late. Like, he could very much blackmail them and, like, keep them under his control.
Yeah.
In June of 1976, Barbara was used as bait to lure in a French tourist named Jean-Luc Solomon. Charles promised him a night with Barbara, who was quite pretty and leaned into the whole pretty hippie flower girl vibe.
Mm-hmm.
The gang drugged Jean-Luc and left him to die naked on the balcony of his Ranjit hotel room. Hotel maids found him the next day and took him to hospital, where he later died. Charles then was in Agra, where he found himself in the company of a bunch of engineering students from Tarbes, France, who were traveling to Delhi. He decided to join them for dinner at the Vikram Hotel, where he gave everyone pills that were supposed to prevent against dysentery, because he's such a nice guy.
So nice. So kind.
And I read in, like, a few different articles, it was, one article said there were 60 students, mm-hmm. another article said there were 20, but he decided to join them, and the pills were actually a mixture of sleeping pills and laxatives.
Oh shit.
A combination that was previously tested on Barbara.
Oh no.
But to his surprise, the drug did not affect the victims the same way they did mm-hmm. on Barbara. It didn't slowly take effect like it would previously. Mm-hmm. Instead, it hit them immediately, and people just started vomiting and collapsing at the dinner table. And since he was the only person who didn't pass out, the hotel staff grabbed him while he was trying to dip.
Yep. And he gets arrested.
Yes, sir. And I'm not sure what happened to John Duisma. He was just there. But Barbara Smith and Mary Ellen Ether confessed to the crimes pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara agreed to give evidence against Charles, but they didn't want to let her skip country before the trial, so they kept her locked up with Mary Ellen Ether, who also agreed to give evidence against Charles. Unfortunately, Mary choked at the stand and changed her story as soon as Subraj faced her. And they were sentenced to 2 years each.
Mary, why?
Mary. In May 1977, both Barbara and Mary were found unconscious in their cell. What happened was they befriended a prison doctor who stole barbiturates from the pharmacy for them. Mm-hmm. They left a suicide note saying how depressed they were,
mm-hmm.
but made a full recovery in time for Subraj's trial. So July 28, 1976 was the trial for the murder of Jean-Luc Solomon in New Delhi. Charles was represented by a lawyer named Jack Vergès. And I was reading this man's biography on Wikipedia at 2 in the morning, and I was just, like, blown away. Like, this guy, I'm going to mention him a little bit here because he has a crazy list of achievements. For lack of better words.
Like the lawyer, right?
Yeah. Do you know him?
No, I don't.
No? Okay. So Jack Vergès is a really famous lawyer who was known for representing well-known war criminals. His nickname was the Devil's Advocate. And if you look at his Wikipedia page alone, Charles is not even on there because his clients were even more high profile than Charles was.
That's insane. See, right? That's my thing, is like when people take on these cases, but they also know that, I think one of it is like, you know, you're going to make money from it, right? Because you have to, high profile killers always have to like pay big bucks for their lawyers. So they know that they're like going to make money. Mm-hmm. But like how, I guess for me, I'm like, where are your morals at? Like, that's the thing. How do you deal with yourself?
I don't know. Because this guy, he's very, I think he's very passionate of a man. So quick facts about Jacques Vergès. He was born in 1925 to a Vietnamese mother and French father, which was you know, pretty common.
Yeah.
He earned his law degree at the University of Paris. He was imprisoned for activism in the 60s and temporarily lost his license to practice. He was a supporter of the Palestinian Fedayeen and disappeared from 1970 to 1978 and returned with zero explanation. I don't know what this guy's been up to, but...
So he just, like, came back in time to be his lawyer.
Yeah.
Shit.
Some of his clients were Nazi Calouste Barbie, aka the Butcher of Lyon. Calouste Barbie personally tortured primarily Jewish prisoners and members of the French Resistance, as well as a bunch of other war crimes and government coups.
Mm-hmm.
He also represented Carlos the Jackal, a Venezuelan terrorist who was responsible for an attack that killed 11 and injured 150 others in the 80s. Another client was Q Samphan, former Khmer Rouge head of state, and Holocaust denier Roger Garotti, who claimed the death of 6 million Jews was a myth.
Holocaust deniers are just, like, another thing to... I don't have, like, the words to explain how much it just, like, perplexes me that they're... I mean, there's, like, Holocaust deniers, there's, like, flat earthers, and, like, people... It's just all the conspiracy
Anti-vaxxers.
Like, just a bunch of things... Not even anti-vaxxers, the crowd where it's just like COVID does not exist at all.
Illuminati. 5G.
Oh my god.
It's Pizzagate.
The things.
Yep. Titled his autobiography The Brilliant Bastard. And he said he would even defend Bush, but only if he agreed to plead guilty.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so that's a little bit on Jack Vergès, because I thought his Wikipedia was too wild to not share. But yeah. Charles was convicted of Jean-Luc Solomon's murder, and Marie was acquitted, but she remained in prison for Avoni Jacob's trial, which was the other guy that they killed.
Mm-hmm. The Israeli guy, right?
Yeah, the Israeli student. Mm-hmm. I'm unsure of his actual sentence length, but he was supposed to get out in 1988, so about 12 years. Barbara and Mary were pardoned and released in July 1978.
Mm-hmm.
As for Marie Leclerc, his girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
she was found guilty of murdering Avoni Jacob and drugging the other students, and was sentenced to 12 years in jail. Both Marie and Charles were imprisoned at Tihar Prison, which is the largest prison in India.
Mm-hmm.
Charles was placed in a cell measuring 3.6 meters by 3 meters, but was often allowed to wander around the jail and gave interviews with reporters and journalists that he made them pay for.
Oh my god.
Which included Clark and Neville, who wrote the book that I mentioned earlier. So they published that book in 1979 after Charles thought that the confessions couldn't affect him since he was already in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But through these interviews, he confessed to at least 12 murders, but later recanted them all when he realized that they might hurt him in the future.
Lamau.
According to Sunil Gupta, former superintendent of the Tihar jail and one of the co-authors of the book Black Warrant, Confessions of a Jihar Jailer, said that while in prison, Sobhraj would get massages and cooked meals from the other inmates as payment for writing their petitions, like their appeals, since he knew Indian law very well.
Yeah.
As you probably might guess from his interactions with the law.
Yeah.
He also would play cards, badminton, and chess with not only prisoners, but also with jail officials.
See, that's like, I feel like that's also a sign of how, like, his charisma, right? Like, holy shit. The amount of, like, persuasion that you have to put into that, or, like, to being quote-unquote likable.
Yeah, and I think a part of it is, as well, like, I think a lot of it was he would bribe them, but he'd also blackmail them because, you know, like, he was writing all their appeals for them, so he knew, like, the dirt on a lot of them. Yeah,
that's really smart, like, in a very fucked up devilish way.
Throughout his sentence, knives, tableware, and an electric heater were confiscated from his cell. He also smuggled a voice recorder, which he then used to blackmail any corrupt officials in the jail.
Oh my god.
Apparently he was actually pretty well-liked and generous, helping pay for a fellow inmate's daughter's education. This inmate later vouched for him on his release. So he actually made, like, a good handful of friends.
In jail.
Including prison officials.
Yeah.
And at one point, him and a jail warden were caught smuggling narcotics into the prison. Both of them had cases registered against them for this. And he was also apparently a ladies' man, with at least 30 different women visiting him. According to him, they were mostly journalists and MA students, and only intellectuals were allowed to visit him.
Only.
Only. He would meet them in the guest house of one of the jail's top officials, where he changed into a suit with a scarf. And I'm guessing he was able to attain this privilege through blackmailing.
Yeah, probably.
There was even a rumor that Marie was allowed to meet Charles once a week so they could do the dirty. He slept with many of the women, including his own lawyer, Snae Senger.
Oh my god.
And actually was engaged to at least two of them.
It's a world of polygamy out here, I guess. Maybe that's... Yeah.
One of which was Jacqueline Kuster, a German prisoner who was locked up on drug charges. And another was a young Punjabi woman who fell for him after reading his biography by Neville and Clark. As for Marie, she was granted bail by the Supreme Court of India in appeal of the 1982 conviction and a life sentence for conspiracy to murder. The courts gave her permission in 1983 to return to Canada for 1 year for treatment of ovarian cancer. The condition was that she had to report to the High Commission of India in Ottawa every 3 months and had to go back to India as soon as her health allowed for it. Apparently, she maintained her innocence upon return to Canada, saying she was sad to leave India and that the Indian people are good people. She didn't feel any bitterness. In late 1983, she came out with a book called Je Reviens, an autobiography denying her involvement in Charles' murders and denying that she ever loved him. She apparently claims that she was a victim of Charles' manipulation. Marie passed away in April of 1984.
Damn, so like 2 years after she got out, basically?
Well, not really got out, because she was like technically still a prisoner.
Did she die from her ovarian cancer?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
She succumbed to the cancer.
Yeah.
In 1986, 12 years into his sentence and 2 years before he was set to be released, Charles attempted an escape.
Of course he did.
He befriended a 28-year-old British drug dealer, David Richard Hall. David was allowed by guards into the prison for Charles' birthday, and so he drove his van in. He handed out grapes, fruit custard, and other confectionaries, laced with sedatives, to the guards, okay, the warden, and the assistant superintendent, who were all there to celebrate Charles' birthday.
What a party. I know. Everyone come celebrate my day of birth, and I'm gonna poison you all. Also, did they not think this through in a sense, like, I guess in his trials, did it not come out that he poisoned people with, like, by offering them food?
No. Probably.
Maybe it did, maybe it
didn't.
I'm
sure it did.
Then I feel like this is really dumb to let them, like, just free-handle food when you know that that is his M.O.
Well, I mean, he didn't handle the food. David did. Because David's an outsider, you know? He's not in jail. He's fine. He's just a worker for the confectionery company who hands out stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, half an hour later, the guards woke up, and Charles and six other inmates successfully escaped in David's car.
Nice.
3 weeks after the escape, he was tracked to Goa, a state in India, by undercover officers, and was caught in a trap at a seafood restaurant and rearrested on April 6th of 1986. According to the media at the time, he knew full well that he would be caught, but he did it to extend his prison sentence in India. And he actually wanted this because it would allow him not to be extradited to Thailand upon his intended release, where he was facing murder charges punishable by death. These charges expired in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And so his plan actually worked because 10 years were added to his existing murder sentence and he would not be released from Tihar prison until February 17th, 1997.
This guy really, like, thought things through. Damn.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I mean, he just didn't want to die.
Yeah.
David, the drug dealer who helped him out, was imprisoned for his help on the prison break as well, by the way. I don't know where he is now, but...
Rip. Everyone's just, like, suffering because of their association to him.
Yeah. Literally anyone he comes in contact with just has, like, a miserable time.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, he was half Indian and half Vietnamese, but he was born in Vietnam. but he claimed that he was a French citizen because France ruled Vietnam at the time of his birth. Remember our little fun fact at the beginning?
Yeah.
So 7 weeks later, France gave him a travel permit and they deported him to France on April 8th. Upon his arrival in Paris, he had developed quite a reputation and took advantage of this by charging fans $5,000 to take photos with him and often did media interviews. He also tried to sell the rights to his story for $15 million USD. He didn't successfully sell the story.
Good.
According to Charles, Chantal actually flew back to Paris on his release, where he said he was still in love with her, but he was with his Chinese wife now, who was pregnant. They actually maintained a relationship, unsure if it's romantic or platonic, mm-hmm. but Chantal and him did maintain their relationship until at least 2011. In 1997, when he got out, he arrived and was interviewed by Andrew Anthony, a British reporter for The Observer. According to Andrew, upon his arrival to the hotel room where Charles was staying, Charles offered him an open bottle of Coke, which he politely declined.
Good.
Because that's how Charles often poisoned his victims. Charles refused to talk about the murders in the interview and only wanted to talk about how he was going to make money now that he's free. He sought out Andrew for his literary piece on Sobhraj that he published previously, as well as his background and interest in film, asking for a recommendation to a literary agent. Charles even went to London to meet Farouk Dondi, a novelist and scriptwriter. Dondi said that Sobhraj wasn't actually as charismatic as he sounded and was an existential amoralist, saying if he saw a gold necklace and wanted it, he'd think to himself, I want that gold necklace. There seems to be a human being attached to it. Now, if I get rid of that, then I can have the necklace.
Easy. That great problem solving.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Dondi and Andrew actually met up a few years later, where Dondi told him about how Charles wanted to set up an antique furniture shop and how he wanted Dondi to lease the shop as a British citizen so that Charles could use it as a front for selling arms. He also said that he spoke to Chantal, who told him that Charles was receiving money from the CIA to help him move to the US under a false identity.
Of course.
And the CIA has done some pretty weird shit. Mm-hmm. So this isn't like a super far-fetched story. But it's still like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And, so how Chantal came back. Dondi said that Chantal inherited some land. And when she came back, Charles got her to sell it for about £40,000. The story goes that Charles took the money, drove to Holland, gambled, and lost all of it. Apparently, when Dondi asked why she came back to him, she just said, because I love him. And she also told him her theory is that Charles can't live without prison because he enjoys the fame of being somebody in a prison.
Yeah, that would make sense. I feel like he likes being that notorious person.
I think he just likes having something going on at all times.
Yeah.
You know?
But dude, just fucking find a hobby that isn't killing people. Like, it's pretty simple. There are a lot of hobbies out there, right? Like, you just gotta look for them, buddy.
Fucking write a book. Like, fucking learn how to paint.
Yeah. Like,
crochet. Knit a scarf.
Pick a hobby. Just don't kill people.
Have we done this before? I feel like we've done this before.
I think we have. I feel like we definitely have had this. Where we're like, you seem bored. Just take up a hobby that isn't murdering people and you'll be fine.
If we had merch, it'd just be a list of things you could do instead of killing someone.
Yeah. It'll be stickers.
Can you imagine? It's just like, you're pissed off at someone, you just slap a sticker on their face. Touch some grass. A journalist named Hoi Nu Hozel contacted Charles after his release. She was a young postgraduate student who read about his life and was interested in learning more about him. Sobhraj gifted her a pair of gold earrings and a Parker pen, which is pretty expensive luxury pen brand. According to Hazel, he said that the people he killed were not good. They were antisocials. He apparently had several women like this in his life, just like friends that he talked to that he didn't have like a relationship with, but he would send them gifts, and like he called them his sisters. Okay, James Charles.
Hey sisters.
Hey sister. Can you imagine getting a phone call from like this French dude? Bonjour. Oh, that was a horrible French accent. I'm sorry. Don't come at me. In 2003, after that, Charles was pretty quiet for a while. In 2003, a journalist named Joseph Nathan traced Sobhraj and found out that he was staying at a 5-star hotel in the capital of Nepal under this name, C. Gurmura. Gurmura was one of Sobhraj's last names that he often uses. Apparently, Nathan approached Sobhraj at the casino saying, "You look familiar. Are you Charles Sobhraj?" To which Gurmura, quote, quote, responded, "Who is he, a Bollywood actor?"
Yeah, because he wanted to be that famous. You want that level of fame, don't you, bitch?
Nathan also pointed out Gurmura to S. Ramesh, who was a counselor for the Indian embassy in Kathmandu at the time, which is the city where he was staying in Nepal. Ramesh also confirmed that it was Sobhraj due to his, quote, prominent nose. Nathan also deployed a team of photographers to follow this guy and was also able to get a copy of the passport he gave to the hotel. Journalists are no fucking joke, man. They do so much research. I don't know how he had the means to do this, but someone hire this man as a detective. On September 17th, Nathan published an article called The Serpent Living Incognito in Tamil in the Himalayan Times. 2 days after the article was published, at 4 a.m., Kathmandu police raided the hotel where Charles was reportedly staying. 2 days after the article was published, at 4 a.m., Kathmandu police raided the hotel where he was reportedly staying and arrested him in the middle of a game of baccarat on suspicion of the 1975 murder of the American tourist. They also charged him with coming to Nepal in 1975 with a fake passport. This case was dropped, but he was rearrested for the murder of the American Connie Joe Bronzik. According to Sobhraj, he returned to Nepal for reasons known only to himself. In one interview, he claimed that, "I'm a busy man with my own film production company in Paris. I came here to make a TV documentary on local handicrafts and to see if I can do some humanitarian work." In another interview with Andrew Anthony, the same man who he reached out to when he was released in 97, he claimed to be a CIA agent sent to catch members of the Taliban buying weapons from the Chinese triads. And at the same time, he was looking to set up a heroin deal on behalf of the Taliban. So he claimed that he was going to double-cross both of them, but the CIA abandoned him when he was caught because he was undercover. Nathan, on the other hand, was pretty sure that he came back assuming that the warrants for his arrest from 1975 had expired, but Nepal was actually the only country where there was still an outstanding warrant for his arrest.
I'm dead.
Another thing to note is that Nepal was kind of a weird place around that time. The royal family ruled Nepal until June 2001, when Crown Prince Dipendra committed a murder-suicide of 9 other royal family members, including the king and queen. That story on its own has been on my list for a while, and I'm definitely going to cover it one of these days. I don't remember when, but it's going to happen. But after that incident, Nepal was declared a republic with Maoists dominating politics and with a pretty high corruption rate. So it wasn't like a super huge surprise that a high profile serial killer was placing $200,000 bets at the city's main casino. 1 year later, after his arrest, he was sentenced to life in prison by the Kathmandu District Court in August 2004. For the murder of 29-year-old Johnny Joe Bronzik and American tourist, as I mentioned earlier. It was around this time that Dondi, the British writer that we talked about earlier, said that he received a phone call from Kathmandu's central jail from Charles. Charles asked Dondi to investigate hot air balloons and asking if a hot air balloon could fit into 2 suitcases. Dondi said no, there's too much fabric and there's also a metal burner that can't be compressed like that. So Charles was like, oh shit, there goes my escape plans.
He really thought he was going to escape on a hot air balloon. Number one, what the fuck? Number two, they're slow. Like,
number three, what the fuck?
Number three, what the fuck? Like, they don't go, like, zoom, zoom. It's not like a, like, you know, it's not a plane. Yeah,
they go up. And if he goes up, like, people can't follow him. He's up.
What if someone decides to take, like, a long range, I don't know, like, a gun that can reach that far? Or, like, I don't know, bow and arrow.
Yeah. Well.
Great plan, Charles.
Anyway, that plan never took off. So.
That was so good. That was a good pun right
Thank
there.
Thank you. Dondi later released a novel titled The Bikini Murders about a serial killer who's arrested in Nepal. And Charles was not happy about that because he didn't want anyone making money off his dirty work, and the two fell out and they stopped contacting each other. In 2006, Charles appealed against the court accusing it of racism, but his sentence was upheld by the Supreme Court of Nepal in 2010. Apparently, he's had multiple appeals, all of which were unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. And 4 years later, in 2014, Charles would turn 70 years old. Now, there's a law in Nepal that once a prisoner hits 70 years old, their sentence is cut in half. So upon his 70th birthday, he will have already served half his sentence, which will make him a free man. But before that could officially go through, in 2015, he was convicted of murdering Connie Jo Bronzek's friend. If you remember, she was accompanied by Laurent Ormond Carrier, the 26-year-old Canadian. He was given a second life sentence.
Good.
And currently remains in Kathmandu prison. In 2017, he had an open-heart surgery. So apparently his health condition is not super great,
mm-hmm.
But he's still in prison, apparently passing time by watching TV and reading newspapers.
Dude, fuck, he's gonna see his own goddamn documentary and he's gonna, like, be like, hell yeah.
Yeah, I know.
They're still talking about me. I hate that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're talking about him.
I know. Imagine if he's listening to us. Fuck off. No.
Fuck you if you are listening to us. Another fun fact. In 2008, he became engaged to Nihita Biswas. She was 20 years old when they met, and she was working as his interpreter and fell for him.
The amount of, like, women who just fall for him, it's just like, wow, okay, cool.
Like, what the fuck? He proposed to her 3 weeks after their first meeting.
Of course.
And they had a wedding ceremony inside Kathmandu Central Jail. She said that he would ask her to bring him chocolates, canned chicken sausages, French bread, guava juice, and green vegetables whenever she visited. She also later appeared as a contestant on an Indian reality TV show called Big Boss, which is the Indian equivalent of, like, Celebrity Big Brother. And she said, I don't know what he was. What he is now is important. He's a good man. I've seen the way he cares for his family, and we have a good relationship. When asked how she would feel if she found out that he was indeed the killer, she said, I would see. Everyone has good sides and bad sides. Even bad deeds with good intentions can be good deeds. Lamau.
That's all I'll say. I think it's like, you can get into a whole argument of, like, bad, like, good and bad people. I mean, everyone has, like, bad qualities and bad traits to them, right? Like, you can't get around that. But I feel like if you're someone who has murdered someone so, like, he didn't care, right? Like, he just murdered.
He was very nonchalant. He never showed any remorse or anything. He's just...
And the argument of, like, he's a changed man. He murdered 24 people. Come on. He's a changed man. Change what, huh? He doesn't give a fuck.
Change what? He still tried to escape prison.
Yeah. Don't tell me he's changed. Miss me with that shit.
So if you remember, Chantel and him were still pretty good friends, and she was, like, sending him funds and, like, supporting him. Apparently she got a very angry phone call from Nihita in 2011. That is the reason why they no longer communicate and why Chantel no longer sends him money. But him and Nikita are still going strong, even though she's been pressured to see him less. Mm-hmm. And her mother is actually now his lawyer in Nepal.
Great.
But yeah, that's the story. And the producer of the BBC miniseries on Netflix, The Serpent, chose not to contact Subraj directly. He said that Julie and her husband, Richard, the two that wrote the book that I mentioned in the beginning, they spent hours and hours and hours in prison interviewing Subraj and taping them. Julie gave us access to those tapes, which meant that we could hear Subraj's account of that period without having to engage with him directly. It felt like the only use of engaging with Subraj directly was to see how he'd lie to you and see how he tried to pull the wool over you. We were able to listen to those tapes from a more objective standpoint. Another individual they reached out to instead was Herman Nippenberg, who is actually one of the characters depicted in the series, and, like, the main character. Mm-hmm. After the first murders in 1975, Herman began to investigate the disappearance of the two backpackers from Holland and discovers the connection between all the victims. He left Thailand 2 years later, serving as a diplomat in many different countries until he retired in 2003. And the research that he did into Charles was actually later used to convict him. So that's pretty cool. He's now in his 70s and chilling in Wellington, while Charles has over 40 years of his life already spent in prison.
Hell yeah. Suck it.
And he will spend another life sentence in there, at least.
Good, because he deserves it. He deserves to be there forever.
Yep. Yep. I don't think he should get out anytime soon.
No.
And from, like, the photos, he was, like, being pulled out on, like, a stretcher from, like, his heart surgery, and, like, he doesn't look like he's doing well.
And I don't think he'll be able to escape this time, like, being that old.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But, yeah. Well. That's the case.
Damn. I don't have anything else to add. That's crazy. I'm gonna go watch a Netflix series. That was like a, hey, back and forth. It was, like, prison versus Charles, basically.
Yeah.
Who can contain who?
Yeah. The world versus Charles. Because this man was all over the place.
Yeah, he was. He was mainly on, like, the east side of the world, right? Like.
Yeah. Well, mostly in Asia. Yeah. And, or, like.
Asia, Middle East kind of areas. A little bit of France. Like. For a bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. His main murders occurred in Thailand, and then, like, a few in, like, Hong Kong, and
yeah what a man.
Really unfortunate for all those people who lost their lives to him.
And some of them are, like, young travelers too, who are just trying to look
most of them were, like, in their 20s.
Exactly. Really sucks that this guy just had to murder people. Really needed to just find a hobby.
Mm-hmm. And they say, I forgot to mention this, but they say, like, it's theorized that he has, like, an antisocial disorder, but they don't really know what he has. There haven't been any, like, evaluations that have come out.
Yeah.
Or that I could find, at least. But yeah, this was a fucking doozy to
research. We still condensed it to less time than, like, whatever that Netflix docuseries is going to be. So,
yeah.
This is a summarized version. But then if you want to go and look and see some pictures, then, I mean, I guess you can go and watch that, too. I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to watch it now. Maybe.
But if you want to see some actual photos, you can check out our Instagram, too. Incrimination.
Well, yeah. And then if you want to check out any show notes with all of the research that Tammy has done, you can go to bit.ly/incrimination, all lowercase.
Those articles are so fucking long.
Yay! I mean, if you like to read, but, I mean, you just listen to all of it, so, you know. But, you know, go check out and support journalism as well.
Hell yeah, because these journalists worked really freaking hard. And, like, there's a few books. I didn't read the books, but, like, I saw, you know, there's a lot of books that talk about this guy, because, boy, was he popular.
Yeah. Every time Elena, like, in Morbid is like, oh, I read this book, I'm like, how do you guys do research? Literally,
how?
Because they read books in, like, a week, I swear, and like, how do you find the time? Maybe they're like, I don't get it.
Well, they're being paid full time to do it, but.
Yeah. Does Elena still work at the morgue?
Oh, yeah.
Because she had a job, and then I guess Ash doesn't
is a hairdresser
work right now. Yeah, but she could be back at work since
I have no idea.
Their COVID situation's a lot better.
Oh, true. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't listened to Morbid in a while because I haven't had the time and energy. But anyway, thanks for listening.
Well, thank you.
Bye!